We're in the final 5 days of Jesus' life. We're on Sunday. Maybe you went to church and they talked about Palm Sunday. That's where they get this from, this passage right here. We read in verse 12 of chapter 12. The next day, the great crowd that had come for the festival, that is the Passover, heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. He's at Bethphage. It's about 2 miles from Jerusalem. It's a suburb of Jerusalem. And the people, they just heard about this Lazarus resurrection. And so there's a huge throng of people that has now come to Jesus. And they're putting two and two together, realizing this is the Messiah. So they bust out palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Palm branches, you might say, why would they bring palm branches? In this culture, this was something that was associated as a nationalistic symbol for the king. 200 years before this, Simon Maccabeus, he was a pseudo-king in Israel. He liberated the Jewish people from the Romans, and they busted out palm branches. And we see this throughout Israel's history. The parallel accounts say that they put their clothes, their robes, down on the walkway as Jesus rode over them. So this was a way of saying, this is the Messiah. They shout out the Hebrew word, Hosanna, which means, save, I pray. Save us. And they're citing, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, Psalm 118, which is a messianic psalm. So just in case you didn't pick up on all that, John makes it very clear. They yell out, blessed is the King of Israel. Here comes King Messiah. He's walking into his capital, Jerusalem, and they're just anticipating the liberation he's going to bring. This is where it gets real weird, real weird. The king is coming into his castle riding a young donkey. Just think about that. In the ancient world, the king would come into his city riding a stallion. Jesus is riding not just a donkey, a little donkey, okay? His feet may have been dragging on the dirt as he's riding this little thing. It would be like, you know, the inaugural address, the president of the United States comes in on a tricycle, okay? As it is written, do not be afraid, daughter Zion. See, your king is coming seated on a donkey's colt, the baby of a fully grown donkey, citing Zechariah 9:9. Jesus said, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Wow. So we've got the King of Israel. And what do we read about him? He rides in on a donkey, not a royal steed, not a stallion. He's the King of Israel. He's got a huge crowd that he's bringing into the city of Jerusalem. If you were on, you know, police duty as a Roman, you'd be seeing this as a threat, as a coup. Here comes the Messiah. And here comes a great crowd of people. Within a few days, this entire crowd of people is going to completely dwindle down to one man and a handful of women. He loses his entire following in less than a week. When Jesus says, it's the hour has come, if you've been reading with us in this account of Jesus' life, you've been seeing that when he says the hour, it's not yet come. And what is he referring to when he says glorification? He's referring to crucifixion. That God's ultimate display of his glory was to hang naked like a butchered animal on a Roman cross. So this is not the king you would be expecting. It's not the king they were expecting. It's not the king that you would expect today. We would expect a king that would liberate from political oppression. That's what everyone wants today. Everything needs to be solved on a big umbrella solution. Everything needs to be very national or political or community. And Jesus had a different view. Jesus believed that you can't get to those issues until you deal with the human heart. How is it that we can get out and create a society, a world of love, if we don't have love in our hearts? So here we're seeing a king unlike any other king. This is the king that you want. He is the ultimate king, infinite. He is God incarnate, and yet he's humble. He's coming into his city riding on a donkey. So at this point, you might be asking, if Jesus was a humble leader, then what would followers of Jesus do? Like if you say, I'm a Christian, that means that you're a little Christ. That was a pejorative term given to Christians. So you're a little Christ. You're a little miniature Christ. And Christians were like, we like that. Yeah, we'll keep that. So if you're a little Christ, you're trying to be like Jesus, what is it that you would be in lieu of this picture of who Jesus is? Well, Jesus teaches, very truly I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if that kernel of wheat dies, it produces many seeds. What's he saying? There's only one way for a seed to bear fruit. One way. That seed needs to be broken apart. It's unavoidable. There's no other ways that seeds can bear fruit in an agrarian society, in a field, in the soil. There's one way this can happen. That seed needs to die. If you want to see fruit, then you need to see a dead seed. And if you have a seed that won't break open, then you see no fruit. Now, there's a certain ambiguity to what Jesus is saying. He says, unless the kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, to whom is he referring? Is he referring to himself? Well, that's what the context would indicate. But he goes on to describe the follower of Jesus. This could be a what's called a Janus verse. A Janus was the Greek god that had two faces. One pointed this way, one pointed that way. This verse could be looking back to Jesus, and it could be looking forward to followers of Jesus. So we see here the idea that in order for us to bear fruit in our lives, we need to be broken open. Ancient people would understand this a lot more than us. Here's a seed in the ground, and after 4 days, that thing starts to grow roots. But after 5 days, that seed is not looking very good. That is a really ripped apart seed. And after 6 days, that seed is just disgusting, really. And then the seed by day 7, you can hardly recognize it. Don't get me started on day 8. That seed is just getting ripped apart. And then day 9, it's just hanging on by a thread, a mangled seed. By day 10, there is no seed. You don't see the seed. What you see is the beautiful plant. The beautiful fruit. And Jesus is saying, this is your life. Are you one of those people that wants to make an impact for others? Like, you're like, I want my life to count. Like, I'm here. That's why I'm here. I'm not here because of, just the good vibes around this building. Like, I'm here because I want to make my life count for Christ. Are you one of those people? Then you need to be broken. Your life needs to be broken open so that the life of Christ can pour out into the lives of others. Paul picks up this metaphor in 2 Corinthians 4, this idea of brokenness. Let's see if we can understand this fuller. He says, God made his light shine in our hearts so that we can know the glory of God. Now we have this light shining in our hearts, but we ourselves are like fragile clay jars containing this great treasure. This makes it clear that our great power is from God and not from ourselves. So what's the metaphor? The metaphor is this. In the ancient world, they had these opaque clay jars, and you would put treasures inside of them. Yes? But you couldn't see inside. It wasn't like a glass jar. It wasn't like a Tupperware jar. It was an opaque clay jar. So you put the treasure inside the jar. And Paul is saying that there's the light of Jesus, the love of God inside our lives, but there's just one problem. You can't see it because you are in the way. With me? That's the metaphor. The believer in Jesus is in the way of revealing the love, the joy, the kindness of Jesus. So how are you going to be able to get at that love of Jesus, where people could look at your life and they could see, I see Jesus Christ in you? How is that going to happen? Answer, breaking. You got to break that jar. It's a fragile clay jar, But God is going to take the chisel and he's going to come in and he's going to start to work away at your jar. You know, you might be coming in here this week saying, my car broke down this week. Or I lost my job. Or, you know, I overdrafted on my bank account. No judgment. This is the Planet Fitness of churches. No judgment here. Okay. All right. But I don't know the circumstances behind that. I don't know if that was your fault, somebody else's fault. Car isn't working, lost your job. All I know is God is going to go to work. He's going to pull out the hammer and the chisel, and he's going to start to work on that clay jar in your life. Now, you're looking at that, and you're saying, that's just circumstantial. You know, just my car, like my car, is 234,000 miles. Do you know, how far away the moon is from us? 238,000 miles. All right. So my next oil change, my car will have made it to the moon. I am greater than Neil Armstrong, okay? This car I drive. So I might look at my car when it breaks down next week and say, yeah, my car broke down. That's just circumstantial. God, however, isn't causing these things. He's not causing suffering in your life. But he's going to use it to chisel away at your outer self, that outer man. My roommates irritate me. I don't know if you've ever had that happen to you. Probably not. People insult me for my faith. I keep failing. I keep trying to move toward people. It's not working. Like, I try to serve God. I try to make an impact. I get up the courage to go share, to go encourage. It doesn't work. I try and share about the love of Christ with other people. It's like there's no interest. And, you know, you go through this. Irritation. People insulting me for my faith. Failure. And God's like, I got just the tool for that. We're going to take this to the next level. I'd like to take a step of faith and impact others for Jesus. Maybe you're going to lead, you know, maybe one of the Sunday high school groups, Bible studies on the weekends. Maybe you're going to step up and lead maybe a men's group, a women's group. Maybe you're just going to start to work with an individual Christian and start to help her develop in her faith. God's like, I got just the tool for that. All right. This says nothing about the other person. I'm not talking about high schoolers or college people or the young person that you're meeting with. I'm saying that when you get into activity for Jesus, all of a sudden you experience brokenness. People don't reciprocate the way that you desire. People don't relate to you the way that you want. The things that you'd like to see, you don't see. The ineptitude that you have when you try to serve God, all of a sudden it was very dormant, latent. Nobody could see it. Then you try and serve and you can't put two words together. Your fear, your anxiety, your depression, your laziness, everything starts to come to the surface. Why? Because you're being broken. That's why. Or other people say, I want to get married. Yeah. And God's like, I have just the tool for that. Yeah. All right. I'm not saying anything about your spouse. Okay. That's not the point. It's not your spouse. It's you. It's you getting into the marriage. Then all of a sudden God starts to break you where you just think everything is totally normal. The way you were raised, the way your parents related, that's all normal. And your spouse needs to get with the picture. And your spouse doesn't want to get with the picture because they have a totally different way of viewing things. So I guess my point is this. What do you do when you have a selfish person like me interacting with other selfish people? This leads to breaking. And the metaphor is this, that Paul is basically saying that the more you go through breaking, it's like causing these cracks in that clay jar. And over time, you start to serve God. You don't retreat into self-protectiveness where no one's going to touch me. No one's ever going to get to me. My heart will never be broken because I'm unbreakable. And you insulate yourself from any kind of pain and misery. If you actually put your heart out there and you go to serve Christ with your heart in your hands, all of a sudden you see that you turn into that seed. You turn into that clay jar that is broken. But here's the good part. The light is inside that jar. So Paul is saying that light of Christ starts to break and burst through outside of the jar so that when people see you, they no longer see that selfish, you know, outer self. What they see is Christ in you. Very, very interesting to hang around with people who have never been broken. Maybe interesting ain't the word. These people are very, very difficult to get along with. They're know-it-alls. They're hypersensitive toward others. They're insensitive when they're impacting other people. Never suffered, never learned. However, if we could get this working in the other direction, people that have been through breaking, where you've experienced these moments where God is working on you. And I could say this is going to take some time. But over time, you start to see, you really can't see it in yourself, but other people start to see it in you, that you're a different person. Yeah, this is it. Watchman Nee, he was no stranger to failure. This guy was a church planner in China during the People's Revolution. He was in prison for 20 years. He died in prison. Here's what he says in his book, The Release of the Spirit. He says, as we shall see, there is just one basic dealing which can enable a man to be useful before God. One basic dealing. What is it? Brokenness. To some, the Lord gives a sudden breaking followed by a gradual breaking. I've had that happen. All of a sudden, God comes in with a real big wham, and you're like, oh, it hurts. Other times, it's just like sandpaper. You know what I mean? It's like, I can deal with that. That doesn't hurt at all. And then 5 minutes later, you're like, it hurts a little. And then, you know, 2 hours later, you're like, make it stop. And then 6 days later, you're like, this is torture. And it's like that in your life, and you're serving God over weeks, over months. You're like, this doesn't hurt that bad. But there's just the perpetuity. It keeps going on. A sudden breaking versus a gradual one. I'd kind of rather have the sudden one, personally. But the gradual, boy, that hurts. Where's this all headed? What are you doing, God? Well, he says, with others, the Lord arranges that they have constant daily trials until one day he brings about large-scale breaking. According to Nee, the timing is in God's hand. We cannot shorten the time. Can't do that. Though we certainly can prolong the time. So true. I read that. I remember reading this book. It's real short, this book, Release of the Spirit. But I always say if you've read it once, you've read it three times. Because Nee just basically pounds the selfishness out of you. Repeats, you're so self-centered, egotistical. And I remember reading this part right here. You can shorten this time. You cannot shorten the time, but you can prolong it. I realized that's exactly what I was doing. Prolonging the time where God was like, the lesson could be over in a month. But instead, I wanted to fight. I wanted to finger point. I wanted to mope. And you're just hurting yourself. That's all it is. How often are prayers for blessing are actually raising up barriers? We long for blessing, yet seem to find God's mercy in crushing experiences. How often when the Lord deals with us, we see only the hand of man. This is entirely wrong. We must remember that it is God who is dealing with us, not our brother or sister or any other person. You don't believe that. You don't. When you are in conflict with another person, when you're having strife, when you're having irritation, your first thought is, if I could just get him out of my life, that would solve everything. He's saying exactly the opposite, that God has put you together to bring about change in your heart. This isn't some kind of a cosmic accident that people are in your life. God has allowed them to be there. Sometimes he even places them there. Why? To change you. That's why. Has the Lord for years disciplined us, but instead of recognizing his hand, we blamed it on other people or on fate? Yeah, I used to have a roommate. This guy was a piece of work, man. He was tough. He was a butcher. He used to work at a grocery store, and he would come home with his butcher apron, his butcher pants, and there was just pig blood and filth and Ebola all over him. You know what I mean? It was just savage. And he would get home and he would just strip down to his tighty whities. I don't know why he wore tighty whities, but he did. And then he would just leave his butcher clothes right there on the floor. And we were like, dude, what are you going to do something with that? And he'd be like, no. Then he would smoke cigarettes, and he'd finish a cigarette, and he'd get rid of the Jerry, and he would keep the filter. You know how a cigarette filter smells? He would keep them in his pockets. I don't know why he did that. I don't know why. Like, I don't know why you keep a filter. Like, and you know how much those stink? You would just get near him, and it was just this, oh. His nose would bleed, and then he would just wipe his nose. Remember, he's a butcher. And then he would just wipe it all over his body, or he would just eat it. He would just eat his bloody nose. Yeah. This guy, and I remember just thinking to myself, like, why, God? Why, Lord? Why are you doing this to me? We blame it on other people. We blame it on fate. You know, that this is just an accident, a circumstance. Nee is saying something totally different. If for no other reason, God put that guy in my life to teach me how to love somebody who's difficult. And teach me he did. Imperfectly. We definitely had our blow-ups with each other. But I got to the point where I was able to say, I love this guy. I love this roommate. He's a friend. He's not just a roommate. He's a friend of mine. Yeah. Oh, may we have the grace to recognize the meaning of his hand in seeking to shatter this outward man. Well, then Jesus continues. That seed needs to die. You need to be broken. And then he says, anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Loving your life. I always picture one of those cartoons where, you know, the big guys eating the grapes. This picture really doesn't do it justice. It's usually like a young woman feeding the grapes to the guy. They call this a hedonism. It's decadence. And I know we all look at that picture and we say, oh, that's just so selfish. That's, come on. You just must really love yourself to be fed grapes like that and just be in a decadent state, you know, just surrounded by nothing. But okay, I don't know. I wonder, how much do I love my life? You know, how much of my thought life is spent thinking about me? How much time I walk into a room, am I thinking about other people? Am I thinking about what they think of me? Lay down in bed, I get in the car, I do any number of things throughout the day. Who am I thinking about? How much time am I sitting on a screen? We look at that picture and we say, oh, sitting there with grapes, just getting guzzled into his mouth. Oh, that's so decadent. Yet we just sit there and stimulate ourselves for hour upon hour upon hour. Why? For me. I love me. What about my sleep? You know, would I ever think of giving up sleep for the sake of someone else? No. I need that for me. Think about your spending. How much money do I spend on myself? Am I a giver? How much do I give? How much do I spend? Do I really need that? Like, oh, I'll catch myself saying, well, I can afford it. What does that have to do with anything? You can afford it. Of course you can afford it. The question is, should you buy it? Do you need it? Is this a necessity or is it a luxury? And yet I'm sitting there on Amazon, click, 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 buy, 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 buy. Can't wait for the next thing. Failure to persevere. When people are difficult, am I just the one who just says, you know, I'm done. Sick of this. Don't deserve this. You know, we look at that picture of that guy in the toga and just say, that's just totally, yeah, he loves his life. You love your life too. You love your life quite a bit. And this was Jesus' most repeated teaching. He was saying this all the time. If you want to keep your life, you got to lose it. If you lose your life, you'll keep it. He says it in all four Gospels once, and he says it in two Gospels twice. So he was just saying this round the clock. And this is the key. This is the key to a happy, fulfilled life, to be able to give your life away to others. Well, Jesus says, whoever serves me must follow me. Where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. He was just talking about the cross. So the servant is going to be with me. Where is he going to be? Nailed up to a cross. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. Is that what I should say? No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. This is interesting. How did Jesus deal with the suffering, with the breaking of himself? We're talking about our individual breaking. Jesus is looking at the cross, and he didn't numb himself. He didn't run. He wasn't a runner. He didn't self-medicate. He didn't quit. He stayed. How did he do it? How is it that you can actually get to a point where you're facing suffering and breaking and giving up your life for others with courage? Well, you need to work this through the way Jesus did. First, he opens up and just felt like it was totally appropriate to share his feelings with God. There's no need to hide from an omniscient being. You don't need to do that. So Jesus said, "My soul is troubled." The Greek here is traumatized. His soul was just, he couldn't handle the emotion flowing through his body. The idea of facing the cross was just traumatizing. And he just shares this right in front of God. "What shall I say?" So he shares his feelings. Then he shares his thoughts. "God, I don't even know what to say. I'm hurt. I'm confused. I'm scared." And he just verbalizes all this to God. He doesn't go around to people and, you know, blurt around to them. Takes us right to God first and foremost. Then he says, should I say, "Save me? Should I pray that? Can't do that. That's the very reason I was here." So what does he do? What's he doing? Can you see it? What's he doing? "Save me? No, I'm doubling down. I'm going to commit to doing what is true and doing what is right." You know, there's sometimes that you don't feel like doing something. There's sometimes that you don't feel like going out and getting involved in someone's life who's kind of irritating to you. And yet you do it because it's true. You do it because it's right. And there could be risks. There could be pain. Taking a step of faith. And yet Jesus just commits to this and then he concludes, "Father, glorify your name." That would be a good way to end any prayer. Because that is a prayer that God will always answer. Many prayers I pray, I don't know. I don't know if it's in his will or not. This one is always in his will. So God hears this and a voice came from heaven. "I have glorified my name and I will do it again." And Jesus said, "When I am lifted up from the ground or the earth, I will draw all people to myself." He said this to show the kind of death he was going to die. What's that mean? What he's saying is that when Jesus' feet were lifted up off the ground and when he took up the cross is the mechanism, the magnet, that would draw all people on earth to Jesus. That there's something when you hear about the cross is in one sense scary, it's horrifying, it's terrible. But there's another sense that you hear about it and you say, "That is the most attractive thing I've ever heard. Never heard anything like that. That God would come in human flesh and take up the cross for me? He would do that for me?" Yeah, as a magnetic warmth that just brings you to God where you say, "Yeah, I can drop all the pretensions. I can drop all the good works, the self-righteousness, and just come into God's presence." Yeah, drawing all people to himself. Maybe you're here tonight. You're sitting here and you're like, "How did I wind up in a Bible study? How did I get here?" This right here. Jesus is drawing you to himself. That's why you're here. It isn't a cosmic accident. It's not a mistake. You're here so that you can come to know God and experience this humble king, servant leader. Jesus said to them, "You are going to have the light just a little while longer. Walk while you have the light before the darkness overtakes you. Whoever walks in the dark does not know where they're going. Believe in the light while you have the light so that you may become children of light." This goes back to the prologue of John. People saw that the light had come into the world, but they wouldn't accept it. They wouldn't receive it. But to those who did receive it, he gave the right to become children of God, children of the light. What this means is that there is a temporary window in which you can come to know God. You know, when your phone is ringing, you know, it's that job opportunity. It's your, you know, you applied, you did an interview, and the phone is ringing. when the phone rings, there's a limited window. It's going to go to voicemail. You got to pick up the phone. You got to answer it right then. And when God is calling to you and he's saying, I want you. I love you. You know, ever since you were a baby, I've been with you. I want you. I died for you even while you were my enemy, even when you hated me. I wanted you. And when you hear that from God, that is the time to come to Christ. So if you're here tonight and you can't remember a time that you invited the death of Jesus to pay for your sins, do that here with us tonight. That's something that I can't really explain what it'll be like. It's different for everybody. But I do know that you're going to walk out of here knowing this was the best day of your entire life. Because you made a decision that will be eternal. Having your afterlife figured out, knowing God. Believe in the light while you have the light so that you may become children of light.